cops. She momentarily regained consciousness while they were waiting for the RA. She said she had been attacked at the Upside Down house. Sorry, never heard of it. Okay, anything else on your plate like this? Somebody grabbed on the stroll? I'll have to think, but I can't remember anything right now. I'll run it through the box, see what comes up. So you sure you'll take it? I can call a couple of my guys back in. They won't be happy, but those are the breaks. Yes, I've got it. You go home. Don't call anybody in. If you want, I'll send you updates over the weekend. Tell you the truth, I can wait till Monday. Going up to Santa Barbara for the weekend with my kids. The less I have to worry about, the better. You got it. Don't fuck with me on this, Renee. Hey, I'm telling you, I won't. Good. Have a nice weekend. Roland was always blunt, and Ballard took no offense. Something about working sex cases had taken subtlety out of her personality. Ballard left her there to finish packing up and went back to the second floor, this time ducking into the vice unit. Like the Bybust guys, the vice cops kept odd hours, and there was never a guarantee that anyone would be in the unit. She entered and leaned over the counter to look into the alcove where the sergeant sat. She got lucky. Pistol Pete Mendez was at one of the desks, eating a sandwich. He was the only one there. "Ballard, what do you want?" he asked. "Come around." It was his usual gruff greeting. Ballard reached over the half-door to where she knew the lock switch was located and let herself in. She went into the alcove and pulled out a chair opposite Mendez's desk. "Ramon Gutierrez," she said. "I'm working follow-up on that case. You guys hear anything about it last night?" "Not a peep," Mendez said. "But we were working East Hollywood, and that's a whole different kettle of fish from the Dragon Walk." "Right. When was the last time you were over there on Santa Monica?" "Been about a month, because things have been pretty tame there. But it's like cockroaches. You can fumigate, but they always come back." "You heard anything about a bad actor picking up pros and hurting them?"
"Not in a long while."
Ramon was worked over with brass knuckles. The guy was also a biter. "We get our fair share of biters, but nothing comes to mind with brass knuckles. Is your he-she gonna make it?" "That remains to be seen. Still in a coma at Hollywood Press for now. But they'll be moving her down to county as soon as they realize they don't have a paying customer."
"That's the way it goes."
"Her?"
"Yeah, her."
"You have a file on Ramona I could borrow?"
"Yeah, I'll get it for you. But it's under Ramon Gutierrez, last I checked." "What else you got?"
"You ever heard of a place called the Upside Down House? Ramona said it to the blue suitors who first responded to the call."
Like Roland, Mendez thought about it and then shook his head.
"Not that we know about here," he said. "There's an underground bondage club called Vertigo. Moves around to different locations."
"I don't think that's it," Ballard said.
"Vertigo means dizzy, not upside down. Plus, I don't think this was a club thing. It's deeper than that. This victim's lucky to be alive."
"Yeah, well, I can't think of anything else. Let me find that file."
He got up from the desk and Ballard remained seated. While he was gone, she studied the schedule on the bulletin board next to his desk. It looked like Vice ran operations just about every night in a different part of Hollywood. They put out undercover officers as bait and arrested the Johns once they offered cash for sex. Like Mendez said, it was like cockroaches, something that never went away. Even the internet with its easy connections for free and paid-for sex could not kill the stroll. It would always be there. She could hear Mendez opening and closing file cabinets as he looked for a file on Gutierrez.
"How'd you guys end up doing last night?" she asked.
"Bupkis," Mendez said from the other side of the room.
"I think that thing at the club on Sunset scared people away. We had cruisers going up and down the streets all night."
He came back to the desk and dropped a manila file down in front of Ballard.
"That's what we got," he said.
"You probably could have pulled the whole thing off the box."
"I'd rather have the hard copy," Ballard said.
She would take a paper file over a computer file any day. There was always a chance there was more in the hard file, handwritten notes in the margins, phone numbers scribbled on the folder, extra photos of crime scenes. That was never the case with the computer file. Ballard thanked Mendez and said she would be in touch if anything developed on the case. He said he would keep his eyes and ears open in the streets.
"I hope you catch the guy," he said.
Back on the first floor, Ballard had one more stop before she was in the clear to work the case. The lieutenant in charge of the detective bureau had an office in the far corner of the squad room. The room had three windows that looked out on the squad, and through them Ballard could see Lieutenant Terry McAdams at his desk, working.
Ballard often went weeks without seeing her direct supervisor because of the hours of her shift. McAdams usually worked an 8-to-5 day because he liked to arrive after his detectives were in and had gotten things going for the day, and then he liked to be the last man out. She knocked on the open door of the office, and McAdams invited her in. "Long time no see, Ballard," he said. "I heard you had a fun shift last night."
"Depends on what you consider fun," she said. "It was busy, that's for sure."
"Yeah, I saw on the watch log that before the shit hit the fan at the dancers, you and Jenkins caught an abduction caper. But I didn't see any paper on it."
"Because there isn't any. That's what I want to talk to you about."
She summarized the Ramona Ramone case and told McAdams that she had Maxine Rowland's go-ahead to stick with it for a few days. Technically, Ballard should have started by getting an approval from McAdams, but she knew that as an administrator, McAdams liked to be brought things that were already tied in a bow. It made his job easier. He just had to say yes or no. McAdams said what Ballard knew he would say.
"Okay, have at it. But don't let it get in the way of your normal duties," he said.
"If it does, then we have a problem, and I don't like problems."
"It won't happen, LT," she said. "I know my priorities."
Leaving the lieutenant's office, Ballard saw a small group of remaining detectives gathered in front of the three television screens mounted on the back wall of the bureau. The screens were usually silent, but one of the men had raised the sound on the middle screen to hear the report on the dancer shooting, which kicked off the 5 o'clock news hour. Ballard sauntered over to watch. On the screen was a video from a press conference held earlier in the day. The chief of police was at the podium, and he was flanked by Olivas and Captain Larry Gandel, commander of the Robbery Homicide Division. The chief was reassuring the media and the public that the shooting at the dancers was not an act of domestic terrorism. While the exact motivation for the mass killing was not known, he said detectives were zeroing in on the circumstances that caused the extreme violence. When the report shifted back to the news anchor, she reported that the names of the victims had not yet been released by the coroner's office, but that sources told Channel 9 that three of the victims, all believed to have been intended targets of the shooter, had criminal records, ranging from drug charges to extortion and acts of violence. The anchor then moved on to the next story, this one about another LAPD press conference, to announce arrests in the human trafficking investigation at the Port of Los Angeles, where a cargo container that was used to bring in young women abducted from Eastern Europe had been intercepted earlier in the year. There was a file video showing the stark interior of the shipping container and aid workers offering water to and wrapping blankets around the victims as they were shepherded to safety. It was then coupled with a new video showing a line of men in handcuffs being walked off a jail bus by detectives. But the story wasn't about Hollywood, and the detective with the remote lost interest. He hit the mute button. No one objected, and the group around the screen started to dissipate as everybody moved back to their respective pods or headed out of the station for the weekend. Once she got back to her desk, Ballard looked through the file Mendez had lent her. There were several arrest reports going back 3 years, as well as booking photos that showed the progression of Ramona Ramone's physical changes as she transitioned. There were more than cosmetic changes, like eyebrow shaping. It was clear from the front and side photos that her lips had gotten fuller, and she had had her Adam's apple shaved. There were 3 shake cards clipped to the inside of the file folder. These were 3x5 cards with handwritten notes taken while patrol or vice officers stopped Ramone on the stroll to question what she was doing. Officially called field interview, or FI cards, they were more often called shake cards because the American Civil Liberties Union had repeatedly complained that the unwarranted interviews of people whom the police were suspicious of were actually shakedowns. The rank and file embraced that description and continued the practice of stopping and interviewing suspicious individuals and writing down details about their description, tattoos, gang affiliation, and hangout locations. The cards written on Ramona Ramone largely said the same thing, and most contained information Ballard already knew. Some of the notes revealed more about the personality of the officer than it did about Ramone. One officer wrote, "Holy shit, this is a guy?" The one piece of useful information Ballard gleaned from the cards was that Gutierrez Ramone had no driver's license and therefore no verifiable home address. The official report simply stated the address where the arrest was made, most often on Santa Monica Boulevard. But during the field interviews, she had twice given an address on Heliotrope. The third card said, "Lives in trailer, moves around the 6. This information was good to have, and Ballard was glad she had gone up to see Mendez. finished with her review of the file in Ramon's background, Ballard fired up the computer terminal and went to work, looking for the suspect. Her plan was to start small and go big, to look for local cases that were similar to the attack on Ramon. If she found nothing, then she would widen her computer search to look for similar cases in the state of California, then the country, and then even the world. Working the department's computer archives was an art form. Formally, the system was called DCTS, Detective Case Tracking System. One wrong input in the search parameters could easily result in a no records found response, even if there was a closely matching case somewhere in the data. Ballard composed a short list of details that she would enter and subtract from until she got a hit. Transgender. Bite. Brass knuckles. Bound. Prostitute. Santa Monica Boulevard. She entered them into the search of all cases in the archive and got a quick, no records found. She eliminated Santa Monica Boulevard, searched again, and got the same response. She continued to search, dropping words as she went, and then trying different combinations and adding variations, using bindings and tied up instead of bound, escort instead of prostitute. But none of the combinations scored a hit in the data. Frustrated, and beginning to feel the effects of less than 3 hours' sleep, Ballard got up from her station and started walking down the now empty aisles of the bureau, hoping to get her blood moving. She wanted to avoid a caffeine headache, so she held off on going to the break room for another coffee. She stood for a moment in front of the silent TV screens and watched a man in front of a weather map that showed no sign of inclement weather heading toward LA. She knew it was time to widen the search outside the city. With that would come a lot of desk work as she tried to chase down far-off cases that might be connected to hers. It would be a slog, and the prospect was daunting. She returned to the desk and put another call in to Hollywood Presbyterian to check on her victim, on the off chance she had miraculously come to and could be interviewed. But there was no change. Ramona Ramon was still in an induced coma. Ballard hung up the phone and looked at the list of attributes that had failed to draw a hit from the databank. "Keywords my ass," she said out loud. She decided to try one more angle. California was one of the four states that made possession of brass knuckles, or metal knuckles, as they were referred to in the statutes, illegal. Other states had age minimums and laws against using them in the commission of a crime, but in California they were illegal across the board, and violating the law could be charged as a felony. Ballard typed in one more search of the LAPD's data archive, asking for all cases in the last 5 years involving an arrest for possession of brass knuckles, felony or misdemeanor. She got 14 hits on separate cases, which she thought was surprisingly high, given that the weapon had so rarely come up in cases she had worked or even had known about in her 10 years as a detective. Ballard checked the wall clock and started the task of pulling up expanded records on the cases to see if anything in the summary reports remotely connected an MO to her case. She was quickly able to move through most of the cases because they involved gang arrests in South Los Angeles, where it appeared to Ballard that brass knuckles were employed in lieu of firearms by gangbangers who probably didn't know they were illegal. There were other arrests, involving pimps and mob enforcers for a possession of metal knuckles, with their intended use of the weapons being obvious. And then Ballard came across a 3-year-old case that immediately held her attention. A man named Thomas Trent had been arrested for possession of brass knuckles by the Valley Bureau Vice Unit. The case had not come up on Ballard's previous keyword search because none of the other words in her combinations was in play. Trent had been charged with the brass knuckles offense only, nothing else. And yet it was a vice case. That contradiction was what had initially caught Ballard's eye. When she pulled up the digital case file, she learned that Trent, 39 at the time, had been arrested during a sting operation at a motel on Sepulveda Boulevard. The summary report said he had knocked on the door of a room at the Tallyho Lodge near Sherman Way, where the Vice Unit had been sending men who had connected online with an officer posing as an underage Latino male, available for submissive roleplay. Trent had made no appointment at the motel, and the Vice officers could not connect him to any of the men who had taken part in the online conversations. They believed he had probably been one of the online suitors, but they did not have evidence of that and could not charge him with solicitation of a minor. But they also did not need to pursue linking him to the online sting once they found brass knuckles in his pockets. He was arrested for felony possession of a dangerous weapon and booked into the Van Nuys jail. The summary report listed the undercover officer who arrested Trent by serial number only. Ballard sent the report to the bureau's printer, then picked up the desk phone and called the department's personnel unit. She quickly had a name to go with the serial number of the vice officer. He was Jorge Fernandez, and he was still assigned to the Valley Bureau's vice squad. Ballard called the Valley Vice Unit and was told that Fernandez was off duty. She left her cell number and a message for him to call her back, no matter what time. She next took a deeper dive into online records and pulled up an abstract on Trent's case. She learned that following his arrest, Trent negotiated an agreement with the district attorney's office in which he pleaded no contest to a misdemeanor charge of possession of a dangerous weapon, paid a $500 fine, and was placed on 3 years probation. The plea was part of a pretrial intervention program that would allow Trent to have his record cleaned if he completed probation without another arrest. On the court records, Trent's home address was listed on Wrightwood Drive in Studio City. Ballard plugged the address into Google and found a map showing that Wrightwood dropped off Mulholland Drive on the northern slope of the Santa Monica Mountains. She clicked on the street view feature and saw what looked like a contemporary ranch house with a double-wide garage. But she knew from the map that the house was on the mountain, and that it was most likely that the structure stretched one or two levels down the slope from the street. It was a very typical design of many of the homes in the hills. The top floor contained the common areas, kitchen, dining room, living room, and so on, while the lower levels contained the bedrooms. There would be stairs or, in some cases, an elevator that led down to the lower floors. Ballard realized that someone unfamiliar with these mountainside designs could view the houses as odd because the bedrooms were on the bottom floors. In that way, Trent's home might be considered an upside-down house. That realization dumped a jolt of adrenaline into Ballard's blood. She leaned closer to the computer screen to study Trent's booking photo and arrest report. The personal details on the report said Trent was a car salesman who worked at an Acura dealership on Van Nuys Boulevard. The first question that struck her at that point was how a car salesman afforded a home in the hills, where price tags easily started in the seven figures. She switched over to a different search site that handled public records and put in Trent's name and date of birth. Soon she was looking at records of a marriage dissolution that occurred 7 months after his arrest. Beatrice Trent had claimed irreconcilable differences in her divorce petition, and it appeared that Trent did not contest the filing. The three-year marriage was dissolved. There was also a record of a lawsuit from 2011, in which Trent was the plaintiff in a personal injury claim against a company called Island Air and its insurer. The record showed only the filing for injuries sustained in a helicopter crash in Long Beach, but not the outcome of the case. Ballard assumed that this meant the case had been settled before trial. Ballard printed all of these reports and then picked up the desk phone and called the dealership where Trent worked. She asked for him by name, and the call was transferred. A voice said, "This is Tom. How can I help you?" Ballard hesitated and then disconnected. She looked at the clock and saw it was just past 6 o'clock and in the guts of rush hour. It would be a miserable crawl from Hollywood up into the valley. There was no guarantee that Trent would even still be working by the time she got there, but Ballard decided to give it a shot. She wanted to get a look at him. Chapter 10. The Acura dealership, where Thomas Trent worked, was at the end of a long stretch of competing dealerships that stretched north along Van Nuys Boulevard toward the center of the valley. It took Ballard almost an hour to get there. She had driven her own van because the city ride assigned to her and Jenkins screamed cop. With its baby shit brown paint, no-frills hubcaps, and grill and rear window flashers. Her purpose was only to get a look at Trent and get a read on him, not to alert him to the police interest. She had downloaded the mugshot from Trent's arrest 3 years earlier to her phone, and she pulled it up on the screen now. Parked at a curb on Van Nuys, she studied it and then scanned the new and used car lots for salesmen. There was no match. The interior showroom was still a possibility, but since the sales booths appeared to be lined along the rear wall, she had no angle on their occupants. She called the dealership's main number and asked for Trent again, just to make sure he hadn't left for the day. He once again answered in the same way, but this time Ballard didn't disconnect. "This is Tom. How can I help you?" There was a salesman's confidence in his voice. "I wanted to come in and look at an RDX, but with this traffic, I may be a while getting there," Ballard said. She had read the name of the model off the windshield of an SUV that sat on a pedestal near the lot's entrance.
"No worries," Trent exclaimed. "I'm here till we shut her down tonight. What's your name, hon?"
"Stella."
"Well, Stella, are you looking to buy or lease?"
"Purchase."
"Well, you're in luck. We have a 1% financing deal going on this month. You bringing in a trade for me?"
No. I think I'm just looking to buy."
Through the showroom glass, Ballard saw a man stand up in one of the booths on the rear wall. He was holding a corded phone to his ear. He put his arm down on top of the booth's partition and spoke into the phone.
"Well, whatever you want, we've got," he said.
Ballard heard the words at the same time the man in the showroom said them. It was Trent, though his appearance had changed some since his bust on Sepulveda Boulevard. He had a shaved head now and eyeglasses. Judging from what she could see of him, he had bulked up as well. His shoulders stretched the fabric of his short-sleeved dress shirt, and it looked like his neck was too thick for him to connect the top button behind his tie. Ballard saw something then and quickly reached into the storage compartment in the center console. She pulled out a compact set of binoculars.
"So, when do you think you'll get here?" Trent asked.
Ballard stalled. She put the phone on her lap and looked through the binos. She focused and got her first good look at Trent. The hand that was holding the phone to his ear appeared to be bruised along the knuckles. She picked the phone back up.
20 minutes, she said. "I'll see you then."
"Good deal," Trent said. "I'll have an RDX ready to go." She ended the call, started the van, and pulled away from the curb. Ballard drove up Van Nuys 2 blocks and took a right into a neighborhood of World War II-era homes. She pulled to a stop in front of one without any lights on and then climbed into the back of the van. She took off her gun, badge, and rover and put them into the lockbox welded to the wheel well. She pulled her wallet out of her shoulder bag and put it in there as well. No matter what happened at the dealership, she was not going to give Trent her driver's license. She had already given a fake name, and she would never risk him knowing her real name or address. She quickly took off her suit next and put on a pair of jeans to go with her blouse. The jeans were loose-fitting, so that she could wear her backup pistol in an ankle holster without it being obvious. After putting on a pair of running shoes, she climbed back into the driver's seat. She returned to the dealership and this time drove in through the entrance and parked in front of the showroom. Before she even got out, a silver RDX glided up behind her van and stopped. A salesman's trick. It would prevent her from leaving. Trent got out smiling and pointing his finger at Ballard as she stepped out of the van.
"Stella, right?"
Without waiting for confirmation, he raised his hand to present the RDX.
"And here she is."
Ballard stepped to the back of the van. She looked at the RDX even though she wanted to look at Trent.
"Nice," she said.
"Is that the only color you have?"
"At the moment," he said. "But I can get you any color you want. 2 days tops."
Now she looked at Trent and put out her hand.
"Hi, by the way," she said.
He took her hand and she squeezed his firmly as they shook. She studied his face as she made sure to apply pressure to his knuckles. He never lost his salesman's smile, but she saw pain pulse in his cheeks. The bruising was fresh. She knew that brass knuckles, if fitted loosely, could easily damage and bruise the hand of the user.
"You want to take a test drive?" Trent asked.
"Sure," Ballard said.
"Perfect. I just need to make a copy of your driver's license and insurance."
"No problem." She opened her bag and began looking through it.
"Oh, damn," she exclaimed. "I left my wallet at the office. It was my turn to pay for Starbucks, and I must have left it on my desk. Damn it."
"Not a problem," Trent said. "Why don't we take the RDX and drive to your office, and then we'll make copies and you drive back here?" Ballard had considered that he might offer that, and she had worked a response into her play.
"No, my office is out in Woodland Hills, and I live in Hollywood," she said. "That will take too long. My wife's already going to be waiting for me for dinner. We go out on Fridays."
"Your," Trent said before catching himself. "Well." He glanced through the glass, into the showroom as if looking for someone.
"Tell you what," he said. "We'll make an exception to the rules this time, if you want to take a short test drive. Then we'll set everything up for tomorrow, and you can come back with ID, insurance, and your checkbook. Okay?"
"All right, but I'm not completely sure I want the car," Ballard said. "I also don't like silver. I was hoping for white. I can get white here by Sunday, Monday at the latest."
"Tell you what, let's roll."
He walked quickly around the car to the passenger side, his arms pumping as though he were running.
Ballard got in behind the wheel, drove the car out onto Van Nuys Boulevard, and headed north. Trent gave her instructions to go up to Sherman Way and then turn west to the 405. She could then take the freeway down to the Burbank Boulevard exit and back over to Van Nuys, completing a driving rectangle that would give her a sense of the vehicle in urban and freeway environments. Ballard knew that the pattern would twice take them across Sepulveda Boulevard, the street where Trent had been arrested 3 years earlier. Trent's plan hit a snag when they got on the 405. It was still a virtual parking lot with evening commuters. Ballard said she would get off early at Van Owen. Most of the conversation up until that point had been about the RDX and what Ballard was looking for in a vehicle. She incorporated mention of her wife into a few of the answers to see if she could get a read on whether Trent had an issue with same-sex couples, but he never took the bait. After exiting on Van Owen, Ballard turned south on Sepulveda. It ran parallel to Van Nuys and would take them right by the Tally Ho Lodge without it seeming like she was purposely going out of their way. The area was lined with cluttered strip malls, gas stations, mini-markets, and cheap hotels. It was prime territory for vice operations. As she drove, Ballard scanned the sidewalks, but knew it was too early in the night to catch street prostitutes out and about. After they crossed Victory Boulevard, they caught a light, and she used the time to survey the area and comment. "I didn't realize it was so sketchy over this way," she said. Trent looked about, as if seeing it for the first time himself, before commenting. "Yeah, I hear it gets pretty bad over here at night," he said. "Pimps, drug pushers, streetwalkers of all kinds." Ballard faked a laugh. "Like what?" she asked. "You'd be surprised," Trent said. "Men who dress up as women, women who used to be men, every variety of disgusting thing you can imagine." Ballard was silent, and Trent seemed to realize that he might have endangered his sale. "Not that I make any judgments on anybody," he said. "I say to each his own, live and let live." "Me too," Ballard said. After the test drive, Ballard told Trent she wanted to think about the purchase and would call him in a day or two. He asked her to come into the showroom and go to his desk so he could fill out a customer information sheet. She declined, saying she was already late for dinner. She offered her hand again, and when he shook it, she clenched her thumb and index finger sharply, causing an involuntary flinch from Trent. She turned his wrist slightly and looked down at his hand, acting as if she saw the bruising for the first time. "Oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't know you were hurt." "It's okay. Just a bruise." "What happened?" "It's a long story, and not worth the time. I'd rather talk about how we can get you into a new RDX." "Well, I'll think about it, and I'll give you a call. Hey, do you mind? I got a boss who's a stickler for documenting our leads. It goes into the performance evaluations, to tell you the truth. Any chance I can get you to give me your number so I can show I took the car out on a valid lead? Otherwise, he'll ding me for not verifying license and insurance." Ballard thought about it and decided it would not be an issue. He would not be able to trace the number to a real name. "Sure." She gave him the number and he wrote it down on the back of one of his own business cards. He then gave a clean one to her. "Have a great date night, Stella." "Thanks, Tom." As Ballard backed her Ford out of its parking space, Trent stood in the lot and watched her go, sending her off with a friendly wave. She drove up Van Nuys Boulevard and back to the same street and spot where she had parked before. She pulled out a notebook and wrote down as many quotes from her conversation with Trent as she could remember. Extemporaneous notes written just moments after a conversation were given greater weight in court than those written much later. She had no idea if her undercover encounter with Trent would eventually become part of a case, but she knew it was the smart thing to do. After putting her notebook away, she climbed into the rear of the van again to retrieve her gun, badge, and rover. She decided she would change back into her work suit when she got to Hollywood Station. Her phone buzzed as she was climbing into the driver's seat. It was an 818 number, and she took the call. It was Trent. "Just looking at the computer here, Stella," he said. "We can get you a white one. They have them all over the place. Bakersfield, Modesto, Downey, plenty of choices. All of them fully loaded, backup camera, everything." Ballard guessed that he was only calling to see if she had stiffed him with a phony number. The fact that she had not seemed to energize him. "All right, well, let me think about it," Ballard said. "You sure I can't pull the trigger on one of these right now?" Trent asked. You would qualify for our end-of-the-day discount. That's a $500 credit on your down payment, Stella. You could take that money and order custom doormats or upgrade the headliner if you want. There's a lot of, no, Tom, not yet, Ballard said decisively. I told you I was going to think about it and I will call you tomorrow or Sunday. Okay, Stella, Trent said. Then I'll wait to hear from you. The line went dead. Ballard started the engine and pulled away from the curb. She started heading south toward the mountains. She checked the dashboard clock. If Trent was working at the dealership until the 10 p.m. closing, then it would be 2 hours before he got home. That was plenty of time for what she had planned. Chapter 11 Ballard sat in the van at the Mulholland Overlook, about 2 blocks from Wrightwood Drive. It was a clear night, and the lights of the valley spread out to infinity toward the north. She had her Rover on, and tuned to the North Hollywood Division dispatch frequency. She didn't have to wait long. A radio call went out to all patrol units, reporting a possible prowler and home break-in on Wrightwood. A patrol unit accepted the call and asked where they would meet the person who reported the incident. The dispatcher said the call came from a passing motorist who declined to identify herself. After another 30 seconds went by, Ballard keyed her Rover. She identified herself to dispatch as a Hollywood Division detective who was in the area and would respond to the call as well. Dispatch repeated the information to the responding patrol unit, so the officers would know that there was a friendly in the neighborhood. The dispatcher then called for an air unit to fly over the Hillside neighborhood with its powerful spotlight. Ballard pulled away from the overlook and headed to Wrightwood. As she dropped down the steep street and took the first curve, she saw a patrol car, its blue lights engaged, parked a block away. She flashed her beams as she approached and stopped the van alongside the cruiser. Two officers were getting out. Since she was in her personal car, she held her badge out the window so they could confirm she was a cop. They were from North Hollywood Division, so they were strangers to Ballard. "Hey, guys," she said. "I was passing through and heard the call. Want some help or you've got it handled?" "Not sure what there is to handle," said one of the officers. "Whoever called it in is GOA, and we don't exactly know where this prowler was. Seems like a bullshit call." "Maybe," Ballard said. "But I've got a few minutes. I'm going to pull over." She parked behind the patrol car and got out with a flashlight in one hand and the Rover in the other. After introductions were made, Ballard volunteered to head up the street, knocking on doors and checking houses. The two patrol officers would work their way down the street. They had just split up when a helicopter came over the crest of the mountain and put its light down on the street. Ballard waved her own light up at it and proceeded up the street. Thomas Trent's house was the third house she came to. There were no lights on inside that she could see. She used the butt of the metal flashlight to bang loudly on the door. She waited, but no one came. She knocked again, and when she was satisfied there was no one home, she stepped back to the street and started sweeping the front of the house with her light, as if checking for signs of a break-in. Ballard turned and looked down the street. She could see the flashlights of the two patrol officers on opposite sides of Wrightwood. They were checking houses and moving further away from her. The chopper had banked out and was following the curve of the hillside, training its light on the back of the homes. Ballard saw an alcove where trash cans were kept, and beyond it a gate. She knew it blocked access to a set of steps that led down the side of Trent's house. It was a code requirement that hillside houses have a secondary means of access in case of a fire or other emergency. She quickly moved around the trash cans to see if Trent had put a lock on the gate, and she found that he had not. She opened it and started moving down the stairs. Almost immediately, her movements engaged a motion-activated light that illuminated the stairway. She brought her hand up and held it out to block the light, pretending to be blinded. She looked up through her spread fingers and checked the exterior of the house for any cameras. She saw nothing and dropped her hand. Satisfied that her image was not being recorded, she proceeded down the stairs. The stairway had landings at 2 lower levels of the house, giving access to decks that ran across the rear of the structure. Ballard stepped onto the first level down and saw it was furnished with outdoor furniture and a barbecue grill. There were 4 sliding doors, and she checked these but found them locked. She put her beam on the glass, but curtains had been drawn behind the doors, and she could not see inside the house. Ballard quickly returned to the stairs and went down to the lowest level, where the deck was much smaller and there were only 2 sliding doors. As she approached the glass, she saw the curtain inside was only halfway extended across the door. She pointed her light at the gap and saw that the room beyond was almost empty. There was a straight-backed wooden chair at the center with a small table next to it. There appeared to be nothing else in the room. As she swept the beam across the room, she was momentarily startled by a flash, but then realized the entire wall to the right was a mirror. It was her own light that she had seen. Ballard tried the door and found it unlocked, but after she started to slide it open, it abruptly stopped moving. She shone her light down into the door track and saw that there was a sawed-off broomstick placed in the inside track to prevent the door from being opened from the outside. "Shit," Ballard whispered. She knew she didn't have a lot of time before the patrol officers doubled back to check on her. She swept the flashlight across the room one more time and then moved down the deck to get a better angle on a partially open door inside the house at the far side of the room. Through the opening, she could see a hallway and part of a staircase going up to the next level of the house. She noticed a rectangular shape on the floor in the small alcove next to the stairs. She thought it might be a trapdoor leading to the foundation of the structure. She walked out to the edge of the deck and pointed the light down over the railing. The beam shone on a lower platform on which the house's air conditioner unit sat. Ballard realized there must be access to the equipment from beneath the house. "Find anything?" Ballard turned quickly from the railing. One of the patrol officers had come down the steps, the older senior officer with four hash marks on his sleeve. His name was Sasso. He raised his light and pointed it at her. Ballard raised her hand to block the glare. "Do you mind?" she said. He lowered the flashlight. "Sorry," he said. "No, nothing," she said. "The gate up top was open, so I thought maybe somebody came down here, but it doesn't look like anybody's even living here." She flashed her beam on the glass doors, revealing the room that contained only the chair and table. Sasso directed his light through the door as well, then looked back at Ballard. His face was in shadow now.
"So you were just in the neighborhood?" he asked.
"I had a meeting down in the valley and was heading over the hill," Ballard said. "I worked the late show and was going in early. You heard about the club shooting last night on Sunset? I wanted to see what they were putting out in the roll call about it."
"And you cross over on Wrightwood to get to Hollywood?"
There was a clear note of suspicion in his voice. Sasso had 20 years in, according to his sleeves. He had probably been party to more than a few radio calls staged by detectives to create reason to case a house. It was called ghosting. "Things were moving slow on Laurel Canyon, so I hopped over to Vineland and it brought me up here," she said. "I was going to shoot over to Outpost and take that down." Sasso nodded, but Ballard suspected he wasn't buying it. "We're going to clear," he said. "We're stacking legit calls and we need to get to them." It was his way of chastising her for wasting their time.
"Sure,"
she said. "I'm out of here too." "I'll call off the bird," he said. Sasso headed back up the stairs. Ballard took one more glimpse over the deck rail before following him. She pointed her light down and saw no exterior access to the platform holding the air conditioning unit below. She was sure that access came from both inside and underneath the house. At the top, she pulled the gate closed and put the trash cans back into place as she had first seen them. She then walked back down the street to her van. The patrol car behind her made a three-point turn and went down the hill. Ballard heard the sound of the helicopter tailing away into the night. She considered returning to Trent's house to make an attempt to get down to the utility platform, but Sasso's suspicions gave her pause. He and his partner might double back to see if she had lingered in the neighborhood. She started the van and headed up to Mulholland. Just as she had told Sasso, she took it to Outpost, passing intermittent vistas of the lighted city below, and then dropped down into Hollywood. She was on Sunset a few blocks from Wilcox when her phone buzzed. It was the return call from Jorge Fernandez of the Valley Bureau Vice Unit. Ballard thanked him for calling back and briefly described the case she was working with an assault victim she was unable to speak to.
"So how can I help you?" Fernandez asked.
Ballard noticed as she passed the dancers that an FSD van was parked out front, and through the open front doors she could see bright lights inside, the kind used at crime scenes. She wondered what could be going on there 20 hours after the crime.
"Hey, Ballard, you there?" Fernandez prompted.
"Oh yeah, sorry," she said. "So, I have this guy. I wouldn't call him a suspect yet. Let's say he's more on the level of a person of interest."
"Okay, so What's it got to do with me?
You arrested him 3 years ago on a vice sting up on Sepulveda Boulevard.
I've arrested a lot of people up there. What's his name?
Ballard turned down Wilcox toward the station.
Thomas Trent, she said.
There was a pause before Fernandez responded.
Nothing, he said.
Rings no bells.
Ballard gave him the date of the arrest, said it was at the Tally-ho, and that Trent was the guy who had brass knuckles in his pockets.
Oh, yeah, that guy, Fernandez said. I remember the brass knuckles. They had words on them.
What words? Ballard asked. What do you mean?
Shit, I can't remember. But each one had a word on it so that it would leave a mark or a bruise that said the word.
There wasn't a description in the arrest report. It just said brass knuckles.
I'm thinking.
Were you with a partner? You think he would know? It could be important.
It was a task force. The whole unit was out there.
I can ask around, see who remembers.
Well, tell me about the arrest, if you can.
This guy brought brass knuckles to a motel room where he thought there would be an underage prostitute, and he ends up on probation.
How does that happen?
Good lawyer, I guess.
Seriously? You can't give me anything else?
Well, we were setting up in the room because we had one of these creeps coming at 10. But then there's a knock on the door at 9, and it's your guy, Brass Knuckles. We were like, what the fuck is this? So we jammed him and found the brass knuckles in the pocket of his jacket. I remember he had an excuse. He said he was like a used car salesman or something, and went on test drives with sketchy people and needed something to protect himself.
Brass knuckles?
I'm only telling you what he said.
Okay, okay. What happened next?
Well, it was a wobbler. We thought he was probably our 10 o'clock guy, but we couldn't connect him to the script we had running, so we...
What script?
That's what we called the conversations we were working on the internet. So we didn't have intent. We called our filing DA and told him what we had and how we weren't sure he was the one from the script. The DA said to arrest him for the knuckles, and if we connected him later, we could add it on. So we booked him as instructed, and that was it.
Was there ever any further work on connecting him to the script?
Look, it's Ballard, right?
Yeah, Ballard.
You have any idea how time-consuming it is to do a computer-to-computer verification? And this guy worked in a car dealership where he had access to computers on every freaking desk. We had him on the knuckles and we booked it as a felony. That was it. We had other fish to fry.
Ballard nodded to herself. She knew how the system worked. There were too many cases, too many variables, too many legal rules. They got Trent on a felony, and that was one more dirtbag off the street. It was time to move on and get to the next one.
Okay. Thanks for the call back, she said. This helps.
Do me a favor. If anybody in the unit remembers what was on the knuckles, or anybody happened to take pictures, let me know. It could help the case.
You got it, Ballard.
Ballard pulled into the gated entrance of the station's rear parking lot and held her ID out the window to the electronic reader. The steel wall rolled away and she entered and started cruising the lot, looking for a spot to park. The lot was often more crowded at night because there were fewer cars in the field. She entered the station through the back door and saw two drunks cuffed to the lockup bench. Both had vomited on the floor between their feet. Ballard was carrying her suit. She went down the rear hallway and upstairs to the locker room to change. The detective bureau was deserted as usual when she got there. Because she had no assigned desk, she had to check the receptionist desk to see if there were any messages for her. There was one pink slip. A call had come in at 4 p.m. from an 888 area code. The name scribbled on the caller line looked like Nerf Cohen, a name she didn't recognize. Ballard took it back to her regular workstation and sat down. Before checking out the message, she opened the photo archive on her cell phone and swiped back through her pictures until she came to the close-up shot she had taken of the bruising on Ramona Ramon's torso. She used her thumb and finger to enlarge each photograph to look for any indications of a pattern in the bruising that she had deduced had come from brass knuckles. She wasn't sure if it was the power of suggestion coming from Fernandez's information, but she now thought she could see what she had not noticed before in the hospital. She thought she saw distinctive patterns in the bruises on the right and left sides of the torso. Not enough to make out words, but she believed she could see the letter C or O on the left side and either an N or a V on the right side. She realized that the markings she was looking at, if they were words, would likely appear backward and bruising if they read the right way on the attacker's fists. Still, the bruising patterns were significant.
What Ballard was looking at wasn't scientific or remotely conclusive, but it was a little piece of the puzzle that seemed to fit with Trent, and therefore it gave her a nice jolt of momentum. She decided it was time to start committing her investigative moves, the legal ones at least, to a digital record. She checked the clock over the television screens on the far wall and saw that it was an hour to the late show roll call. She could get a lot done in that time. She went to work, starting an investigator's chronology, even though it would not be the first document in the file. She knew from long experience that the chrono was the written centerpiece of a case. She was a half hour into her work when her phone buzzed, with a call from a blocked number. She answered. "This is Ballard." "Good and evil." She recognized the voice of Jorge Fernandez. Her voice jumped up a notch with excitement. "That was on the knuckles?" "Yep. I asked the guys and somebody remembered. Good and evil. The constant battle within man. You get it?" "I get it." "Does it help?" "I think so. Can you give me the name of the officer who remembered? I might need it." "That would be Dapper Dave Almond. We call him that because he's got a certain sartorial style. This is Vice, but he thinks it's a fucking fashion show." "Got it. And thanks, Fernandez. I owe you one. Happy hunting, Ballard." After disconnecting, Ballard put up the photos of Ramona Ramon's bruises on her phone again. Now she could see it. The double O in good, and the V in evil. They read the same backward, or forward. Ballard knew that it was highly unlikely that Trent would have gotten back the brass knuckles he had been arrested with. After 3 years, they would have been destroyed by the property unit. But if the weapons were part of a paraphilia, in this case a sadomasochistic fantasy, it was not a stretch to believe he would go back to wherever he got the original set and buy a duplicate pair. The adrenaline jolt Ballard had felt earlier now turned into a locomotive charging through her veins. To her mind, Trent was no longer just a person of interest. The train had gone by that stop. She believed he was her man, and there was nothing quite like that moment of knowing. It was the holy grail of detective work. It had nothing to do with evidence or legal procedure or probable cause. It was just knowing it in your gut. Nothing in her life beat it. It had been a long time coming to her on the late show, but she now felt it, and she knew deep down it was the reason she would never quit, no matter where they put her or what they said about her. Chapter 12. Ballard went upstairs to the roll call room early. It was always a good time to socialize, hear station gossip, and pick up street intel. There were already 7 uniformed officers seated, including Smith and Taylor, when she walked in. 2 of the others were a female team Ballard knew well from crossing paths in the locker room. As would be expected, the conversation underway was about the quintuple murder of the night before. One of the officers was saying that RHD had put a tight seal on internal news about the case, not even releasing the names of the victims as of 24 hours after the crime. "You're inside, Renee," said Herrera, one of the women. "What's the scoop on the victims? Who were they?" Ballard shrugged. "No scoop," she said. "I just handled one of the peripheral victims, the cocktail waitress. They didn't bring me into the inner circle. I saw 3 dead guys in a booth, but I don't know who they were." "I guess they weren't going to bring you in with Olivas in charge," Herrera said. It was a reminder that in a police station there were few secrets. Within a month of her transfer to Hollywood, everyone in the station knew about her losing her complaint against Olivas, even though personnel matters were supposed to be kept secret by law. Ballard tried to change the subject. "So, coming in, I saw FSD was inside there tonight," she said. "They missed something last night?" "I heard they never left," Smith said. "They've been at it almost 24 hours. "That's got to be a record or something," Herrera added. "The record is the Phil Spector case, 41 hours on the scene with forensics," Smith said. "And that was for one body." Spector was a famous music producer who had killed a woman he brought home from a bar. It was a sheriff's case, but Ballard decided not to make that distinction. More officers entered the room, followed by Lieutenant Monroe. He took a position behind the podium at the head of the room and convened roll call. It was uneventful and dry, with the usual reporting of area crimes, including the credit card theft Ballard had handled the night before. Monroe had no news on the dancer's case, not even an artist's drawing of a suspect. His report lasted less than 10 minutes. He concluded by throwing it to Ballard. "Renee, anything you want to talk about?" "Not much. We had the assault last night."
The victim is still hanging in. Happened on the he-she stroll, and anything anybody picks up on that would be welcome. Note that the suspect used brass knuckles. Ask around about that. Other than that, and five people murdered in the dancers, quiet times. People laughed.
Okay, Monroe said.
The lieutenant moved on to housekeeping announcements about scheduling and body camera training. Ballard wanted to leave, but knew it would be rude, so she pulled her phone to surreptitiously check messages down by her thigh. She saw that she had received a text from Jenkins a few minutes before. He was just checking in with her, as was their custom on the shifts they worked alone.
Jenkins. How's it going?
Ballard. I think I found the upside-down house.
Jenkins. How?
Ballard. Prior with brass knuckles.
Jenkins. Cool. Are you making a move tonight?
Ballard. No. Still gathering string. I'll let you know.
Jenkins. Good.
Roll call ended as she was finishing the text exchange. Ballard put her phone away and headed toward the stairs. Monroe called to her from behind as she was making the turn on the first landing.
Ballard, you're not going over to the dancers, are you? He asked.
Ballard stopped and waited for him to catch up.
No, why? She said.
Just wanted to know what my people are doing, Monroe said. Technically, Ballard was not one of Monroe's people, but she let the remark slide. He ran patrol in the division during the late show, but Ballard was a detective and reported to Lieutenant McAdams, the Dayside D Bureau commander.
Like I said in roll call, I'm working the assault from last night, she said. McAdams gave it to me.
Yeah, I didn't get the memo on that, Monroe said.
Did you get a memo telling you to keep me away from the dancers?
No.
I told you, just want to know where everybody on the shift is.
Yeah, well, now you know what I'm working on. I have to go by the hospital for a minute, but I'm around if you need me.
She turned and went down the last flight of steps and moved directly into the detective bureau. She wondered if Monroe was hiding something. She usually worked autonomously, without the patrol lieutenant keeping tabs on her. Had Olivas or someone else from downtown told him to keep her clear of the club and the investigation? The exchange with Monroe unnerved her, but she put the thoughts aside so she could focus on the case she had at hand. She got keys for the late show city ride out of the drawer of the receptionist's desk, then grabbed a fresh battery for her rover out of the charging station. She went back to her desk for her handbag and the radio and then headed out. Once she was in the car, she could immediately tell someone had used it during the day. Someone who had ignored the rule prohibiting smoking in all city vehicles. She opened up all the windows as she pulled through the lot gate and turned north on Wilcox toward sunset. At Hollywood Presbyterian, she badged her way past a security guard and two nursing stations in order to get to the room where Ramona Ramon was laying comatose in a bed. Ballard had asked a nurse named Natasha to accompany her in case there came a time when she needed backup testimony at a trial. The victim actually looked worse a night later. Her head had been partially shaved, and the surgery to repair the skull fracture and limit the impact of the brain swelling had left her face puffy and unrecognizable. She lay at the center of a nest of tubes, drips, and monitors.
I need you to open her smock so I can photograph the bruises on her torso, Ballard said.
Wasn't it done last night? Natasha asked.
It was, but the bruises will look different today.
I don't understand.
You don't have to, Natasha. Just open the smock.
Ballard knew that bruising occurred when blood vessels beneath the skin were damaged by impact and red blood cells leaked into the surrounding tissue. The bruise sometimes grew larger and darker in the 24 hours after an injury because blood continued to seep from the damaged vessels. Ballard was hoping that Ramona Ramon's bruises would now be more defined and possibly even legible. The nurse moved some tubing out of the way, then pulled down the thermal blanket that covered the patient. She unbuttoned the pale blue smock to expose the victim's naked body. There was a catheter attached to the penis, and the urine in the clear tube had a reddish hue from internal bleeding. The nurse pulled the blanket back up slightly, and Ballard didn't know if that was a show of modesty or revulsion. Ballard noted that the right and left sides of the upper torso were fully covered in deep purple bruising. The delineated edges of the red impact marks she had seen the night before were now blurred as the blood continued to spread beneath the skin. If the damage were being seen for the first time now, it would be impossible to deduce that it had been inflicted with brass knuckles. Ballard leaned down over the bed from the left side to study the purple blossoms closely.
Before long, she identified two side-by-side rings of deep purple against a lighter shade of bruising. She believed it was the double O in the word good. "Natasha, will you look at this?" Ballard straightened up and stepped to her left so the nurse could move in. She pointed to the pattern. "What is that?" Ballard asked. "You mean the bruising?" Natasha said. "There's a pattern there. Do you see it?"
"I see, well, maybe. You mean the circles?"
"Exactly. Let me photograph it." Ballard pulled out her phone and moved in close again when Natasha stepped back. As she took photos, she thought about the billboard she had seen all over the city that showed stunning professional-grade shots taken on the new iPhone camera. Ballard guessed that these kinds of photos would never be put on billboards.
"Is that from the weapon?" Natasha asked. "Like maybe he had two big rings on his fingers when he punched this man?"
Ballard continued to shoot, with and then without the flash.
"Something like that," she said.
She moved around to the other side of the bed and studied the bruising on the left side of Ramona Ramon's torso. Here, the purple blossoms were an even deeper color, and Ballard could find no pattern indicative of the word evil. She did know that the deeper color meant deeper injury, and the imbalance between the two sides of the torso indicated that the attacker's power hand was his right. She tried to recall if Trent had done anything during their interaction and test drive earlier to reveal whether he was right-handed. It had been evident that the knuckles on his right hand were painfully bruised. She then remembered him writing down her phone number with his right hand. Ballard took photos of the left side just so she could document the extent of the injuries.
"You can cover her up, Natasha. I'm finished for now."
Natasha started rebuttoning the smock.
"You saw that he's a man, right?" the nurse asked.
"Biologically, yes," Ballard said. "But she chose to live as a woman. That's what I go with."
"Oh," Natasha said.
"Do you know if she has had any visitors, any family?"
"Not that I know of."
"Are they going to transfer her?"
"I don't know, probably."
Hollywood Presbyterian was a private hospital. If family or insurance was not found for Ramon, she would be transferred to a county hospital, where she wouldn't get the same level of care she was getting here. Ballard thanked Natasha for her help and left the room. After clearing the hospital, Ballard drove to a neighborhood in the shadow of an elevated section of the 101 freeway. Ramona Ramon had no driver's license under her current or birth name, and the only address Ballard had found for her was on Heliotrope Drive. It was the address on two shake cards in her vice file and the one given when she was last arrested. Ballard had thought it was most likely a phony. Not because there wasn't a street in Hollywood called Heliotrope, but because she knew something about plants and flowers from growing up in Hawaii. She had often worked with her family on tomato farms and plant nurseries on the dense mountains of Maui. A heliotrope was a plant that blossomed with fragrant purple and blue flowers and was known for turning its petals toward the sun. It seemed to Ballard like a metaphor of some kind, that maybe Ramona Ramon had chosen the name of the street because it fit with her desire to change and turn her petals to the sun. Now, as she followed the road to the freeway, she saw that the address corresponded to a row of old RVs and house trailers parked stem to stern under the overpass. It was one of LA's many homeless encampments, and beyond the row of beat-up vehicles on the street, she could see pitched tents and shelters made of blue tarp and other materials in the hard scrabble yard beneath the overpass. Ballard parked her car and got out. Chapter 13. Ballard knew something about the social structure of the city's teeming homeless encampments. Both the city and the department had been attacked and sued by civil rights groups for ill-advised handling of encounters with homeless people in their communities. It had resulted in problem-specific sensitivity training and what amounted to a hands-off policy. She had learned from those sessions that a homeless encampment evolves much like a city, with a need for a social and government hierarchy that provides services like security, decision-making, and waste management. Many had individuals who served as mayors, sheriffs, and judges. As Ballard moved into the Heliotrope encampment, she was looking for the sheriff. Other than the constant sound of traffic on the freeway overhead, it was all quiet in the camp. It was after midnight, the temperature was dropping into the 50s, and the inhabitants were mostly hunkered down and bracing for another night facing the elements, with walls made of plastic tarp, or if they were lucky, the aluminum shell of a camper. Ballard noticed one man moving through what looked like a debris field, where the people who lived off the trash of others threw their own trash. He was buckling his belt and his zipper was down. When he looked up from the operation and saw Ballard, he startled.
Who the fuck are you?
LAPD, who the fuck are you?
Well, I live here.
Are you the sheriff?
I'm looking for somebody in charge.
I'm not the sheriff, but I got the night shift.
Really?